You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
The Skim invites you to live smarter this election season. Right now, at theskim.com/debate, you can skim all the candidates' resumes, see their priorities for 2020, and know what to expect before the Dems take the debate stage this week. You can find all that at theskim.com/debate. That's theskim, SKIMM.com/debate. And now, enjoy the podcast.
Hi. I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. In 1958, the U.S. Air Force nuked the moon as a show of military force. In 1967, the CIA sent cats to spy on the Soviet government. In 1942, the British built a torpedo-proof aircraft carrier out of an iceberg. Of course, none of these things ever actually happened, but for every plan as good as D-Day, there's a scheme to bomb a city with toxic goat poop or dig a spy tunnel under the Soviet embassy. In a new book titled Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board, intelligence historian and director of the International Spy Museum, Vince Houghton, proves that abandoned plans can be just as illuminating and every bit as entertaining as the ones that made it. And today, I welcome Vince back to the podcast as he takes me on a wild tour of missions and schemes that almost happened, but were ultimately deemed too dangerous, expensive, ahead of their time, or even certifiably insane, including eavesdropping cats, glow-in-the-dark foxes, and one plan to strap incendiary bombs to bats that almost burned down a U.S. Air Force base. Vince reveals some of the CIA's wackier attempts to take out Castro, the Nazi scientist who tried to build a sun gun straight out of a James Bond movie, and the Florida meteorologist who thought it was a good idea to use nuclear weapons to blow up hurricanes. Then, just when you think it couldn't get any crazier, Vince discusses the project that inspired the title of his book, The U.S. Military Plan to Nuke the Moon. Coming up with the International Spy Museum's Vince Houghton in just a moment. Vince Houghton is the historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. He's also the host and creative director of the museum's podcast, Spycast, which reaches an audience of over 3.5 million listeners a year. Now he's authored a new book that is at once funny and frightening at the same time. It's titled Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince, welcome back to the podcast.
Good to be here again.
This was a fun read, I have to say. It is, like I said, a little bit scary, the things that we've contemplated over the years, but boy, it's pretty damn entertaining, too. In the intro, you say that this is a book about desperation and innovation. What do you mean by that, Vince?
Yeah, so the intro actually was almost an afterthought. I just wanted to write a fun kind of tug-in-my-cheek book about some of these operations that never happened, mainly because I just finished writing a very wonky academic book that I spent, you know, hours upon years inside the archives. I'm like, I got to do something completely different. I got to do something more fun. But by the time I got done, I realized that there was an overarching theme in all of these, and that comes down to this concept of desperation. These are all policies, plans, programs, technologies that are developed during either the Second World War or during the Cold War, and where the United States and our allies had true existential threats. And that word gets thrown around a lot. I think the last couple a presidential election, people like Iran's an existential threat or ISIS. Sorry, they're not. By definition, an existential threat is a threat to our existence. As bad as ISIS is or anyone else, they're not threatening our existence anytime soon. McDonald's will still be there. The difference, of course, is that in World War II, the Nazis and the Imperial Japanese were potentially an existential threat, certainly to our way of life. And during the Cold War, the Soviets and their 65,000 nuclear weapons was a true existential threat to the existence of every living thing on the planet. And that means when we have that kind of desperation trying to come up with a way to fight these kinds of wars, cold or hot or otherwise, we might be willing to innovate in a way that we may look back in hindsight and go, what in the world was going on here? What sure. kind of ideas were these guys coming up with? And they are unbelievable. Certainly from a 2019 perspective, you just laugh at them. But that's not what I'm trying to do here.
Yeah. I love the way you put this. You say that if necessity is the mother of invention, then desperation is its drunk uncle.
Yeah. I mean, that comes down to this idea of, you know, the drunk uncle at 2 a.m. calling you on your birthday once a year. Does this come from my past, perhaps? And saying, I got this great idea. Like, this idea is amazing. It's going to make us millionaires. It's going to change the world. And you're like, buddy, this is nonsense. No matter how much logic you throw at them, no matter how much you try to put out the fire inside their inspirational loins, it has to work. And it has to work because they're desperate, because there's nothing else that has. And a lot of these programs kind of fall into that, where the normal way of doing things didn't work. We're falling behind in the Cold War, or we're losing the Second World War. And so very well-meaning people were kind of forced to think outside the box. And in this case, we're talking outside the room, the neighborhood, the universe, to come up with ideas that could potentially solve an unsolvable problem.
Yeah, and my favorite section deals with crazy animal-related projects. Is it safe to say that PETA probably would not approve of many of these ideas?
Yeah, it's a good thing that either A, these were kept secret from PETA, or B, it didn't exist at the time, because even someone who is not a full-fledged animal lover kind of cringes at some of these chapters. The idea that we would be willing to do this to some pretty cute animals. I mean, it's one thing, you know, testing on animals that are kind of ugly. But when you're bringing in kitties, you know, and and cute little like foxes that are all frisky, you're like, maybe we shouldn't be doing this.
This one in particular, you say that you try to insert into every lecture that you give because it has so many lessons and applications. What can we learn from Project Acoustic Kitty? It almost sounds like a band, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's the funny part is this was the official CIA name for it. And this tells us a lot about the Cold War and the ability for agencies like the CIA to do almost whatever the hell they wanted to in the name of national security. And it also tells us a lot about problem solving, because this was a problem that at the time couldn't be solved. And someone had a pretty bright idea. And of course, it didn't end up being a bright idea, but at the time it seemed reasonable. And really what it comes down to is we had a hard time making bugs, acoustic listening devices, back in the 1960s. And mainly because audio technology at the time was not sophisticated enough to differentiate between the conversation we were trying to listen to and everything else. So if you put a bug on the bottom of a park bench, it would pick up everything. And it'd pick up dogs barking and the wind blowing and birds chirping and people walking by and all sorts of noises, including the conversation you're trying to listen to, but not exclusively. Yeah, it couldn't filter. The technology at the time just wasn't capable of doing that. And so the CIA decided, all right, well, what if we're able to get something close enough to the conversation without being noticed, and at the same time has a natural biological mechanism for filtering out this ambient noise around it? And instead of trying to create an artificial bug, they went with a natural resource, which in this case a cat, and turned it into a covert listening device.
Because what was it? Something like the cochlea is able to filter out that background noise. So you needed to have some kind of biological entity that you could use as a recording device.
Yeah, I mean, so the cochlea.
So it's not a crazy magical idea. It actually seems pretty smart on the face of it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the cochlea is this magical thing inside of our ears and the ears of many animals that essentially through millions of years of evolution has been crafted to allow us to have conversations in loud concerts or bars, you know, where you've got music at a million decibels and you're yelling in each other's faces, but you can still understand the conversation. That's something that the CIA had a very hard time artificially creating. And still to this day, again, in their defense, we're still not 100% perfecting the artificial cochlea. There are cochlear implants. There are things that are used now to replace some of sound and hearing loss in people. But they're not even there in 2019. So in the 1960s, they didn't stand a chance. So they said, all right, well, let's find something that has a cochlea already and turn that into a covert listening device. And yeah. So they did that. They cut open the cat. They put a power pack inside its abdomen. They wired the microphones up into its ears, use its ear canal as a natural way to filter and to funnel the sound. And then its tail was the antenna. And then you had your robo-kitty listening device. That was part one. The part two was the real problem.
Yeah, what's that? Because, you know, aside from just the obvious issues of torturing cats like this, it just didn't work, right?
Well, anyone that's been around cats for more than 10 seconds realizes that training cats is almost an oxymoron. The idea of, you know, it's not like dogs or like
there's a saying, in fact, herding cats, right?
Right, herding cats. And so the one version of the story is that that was the problem they ran into, is that how do you get the cat to do what you wanted it to? Because no matter how well you, quote unquote, trained it, its natural instincts would take over. It would get hungry and wander off in search of food. It would get bored and just start, you know, doing something else. Or it would feel some magical, mystical dirt on its body and it would stop in the middle of the mission to lick itself for 20 minutes. All these things were problematic and all these things caused, according to one version of the story, the CIA to cancel the program.
The next crazy animal scheme was the brainchild of someone who you describe as the Professor Moriarty of the OSS. What can you tell us about him?
Bill Donovan was the director of the OSS. So William Donovan was the man that Franklin Roosevelt brought in to direct America's first centralized intelligence agency. And Donovan was tasked with winning the war using subversive methods, using intelligence, using covert action, paramilitary operations, sabotage. And he needed a scientist. And the scientist that he wanted was someone who was not, let's say, limited by morals or ethics or anything else. And the man Stanley Lovell was who he brought in. And Donovan sat him down and said, I want you to be my Professor Moriarty, like in the Sherlock Holmes novels.
Yeah.
Be the guy coming up with all the dirtiest tricks and evil plots to help beat the Japanese and the Germans. And Lovell did not disappoint. He came up with some of the most extraordinary ideas, some that actually worked, some that didn't work. And then the story I tell is one that never got a chance to work.
Yeah,
it was canceled before it actually went into operation.
That involved airdropping goat poop laced with biotoxins. Is that right?
Yeah, synthetic goat poop laced with biotoxins. So, yeah, the idea was the United States would not be the first country to use biological weapons in World War II if the war was going well. And that's an important caveat. And anyone who studied World War II history knows that the first battle the United States was involved in against the Germans went very badly. In North Africa, during Operation Torch, we got involved in a battle called Battle Kazarine Pass. And the U.S. Army just got thwacked up and down, left and right, by Rommel's forces. And this was a bit of a come-to-Jesus moment for the U.S. military. They said, okay, well, things aren't going quite as well as we thought they would, so now maybe we look for a different way of doing things. And it wasn't just that we potentially weren't doing well against the Germans. The worry was that Francisco Franco's Spain, which was a neutral country but a fascist country, would join the war on the side of the Axis. And if that happened, Spanish Morocco would all of a sudden be an important port city and port area within North Africa that the Germans could flood troops and tanks and resources into. So the OSS was called upon to kind of find a way to stop that from happening. And Moriarty, Stanley Lovell, came up with this idea of let's create synthetic goat poop that the North African housefly would be attracted to. And let's lace it with what he called the four horsemen of the apocalypse and biotoxins, things that would make you not dead, but wish you were dead. In which case the flies would pick up the biotoxin off the goat poop and then land either on the Germans themselves, because these flies love going after mucous membranes, eyes, nose, mouth, or the food of the German army. And then the German soldiers would either eat the food or just pick up the biotoxins from the flies itself and would be deathly ill, but not dead. And this would basically knock the Germans out of North Africa.
And this was something that was already an issue, as I recall, in North Africa. I remember, I think it was either our troops or the Brits had some rule, like they had to kill 20 flies a day just because it was such a problem with flies going in the latrine and then crawling all over people's food and stuff.
The North African flies are legendary or getting into everything. And that's kind of what gave Lovell this idea. It's that these are flies that are going to be the perfect vector for this kind of a weapon system. They are all over food. They're all over people. And if they're carrying this bioweapon, that's the perfect way to get the Germans sick.
Yeah, but I have to wonder if that would have been a violation of the Geneva Convention, though. Wouldn't it? Bio-war?
Well, at this point, you know, looking at total war where there is no real thoughts about those kind of conventions and that way of fighting. I mean, we dropped two nuclear weapons in World War II.
Yeah, that's true.
The Japanese experimented with biological weapons, never used them actually in warfare. And of course, we never did, but it wasn't something that we necessarily were going to shy away from because of morals or ethics. Really, the argument was that we don't want to be the first to use it because we don't want the Germans and everyone else to start using biological and chemical weapons. And the idea was maybe they wouldn't if we didn't.
Right.
But that was certainly the case if the war was going well. Once it stopped going well, or once it looked as though it wasn't going to go well in the beginning, our mindset changed a little bit.
It's also interesting because a number of these projects were only scrapped because of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I guess they weren't necessary then. As terrible as it was, do you think that the A-bomb might have saved the U.S. military some serious embarrassment if some of these projects had taken shape?
I think one thing I warn against in this book is counterfactualism, which is kind of a fancy way of saying, like, avoid the what-ifs of history as much as you possibly can. And, you know, there's a chapter in this book about the bat bomb, which to his dying day, the inventor of this idea swore that we could have won the war against Japan with much less casualties, but just as effectively using his technology versus the atomic bombs. Yeah. So there's an argument to be made in both directions. Sure, you know, the atomic bombs ended the war much more quickly than they would have otherwise. We may have gone on for several more months of fighting. There's arguments to be made that the atomic bombs actually killed less Japanese than would have died if we hadn't used them. I know it's convoluted and antithetical, but the idea is that so many of the Japanese were starving and they would have potentially, since they were cut off completely from the outside because we'd sank their merchant marine force, the Japanese would not have been able to resupply. And so a lot of civilians would have died otherwise. But again, these are counterfactuals. And what we want to try to avoid as historians is trying to make up what we think might have happened in history versus just talking about what did happen.
Yeah. Now, before I get off the animals, another project in addition to Project X-Ray, the bat bomb that we tested out as an idea to influence the Japanese, was using glowing foxes to play on their superstitions during World War II. Would this be what you guys call psyops?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is traditional psychological operations where you're trying to get inside the head of your enemy. And in this case, there's a whole lot of racism involved in this. There's a whole lot of ethnocentrism. The idea that
seems like it.
Yeah, the Japanese are going to be spooked by glow-in-the-dark foxes. But this was a legit plan by the OSS in the Pacific Theater to really tap into deep-seated superstitions, or at least what we thought were deep-seated superstitions of the Japanese, whose main religion was Shintoism. And in Shintoism, the fox takes on a special place. It can be a bearer of good omen, but in a lot of cases, it's kind of an evil spirit. And the hope was that if we spray painted foxes with luminescent paint, glow in the dark paint, and sent them in front of our forces, that the Japanese soldier, who wasn't afraid of anything, right? That's why they fought to the death. They weren't afraid of the Marines. They weren't afraid of the American soldier. But maybe there'd be glow in the dark foxes would make them run away. It would make it a lot easier for us to win the battle. Essentially, it's a force multiplier.
Yeah.
It's we can lose less troops if the Japanese give up. And if they're not giving up to the U.S. Marine Corps, maybe they'll give up to a glow-in-the-dark fox.
Pretty crazy stuff.
Well, of course, the problem there is that you're not going to airdrop these foxes. I mean, it'd be cool if you did, but these foxes would have to go in on the water like everybody else.
Uh-huh.
And as good as 1940s era glow-in-the-dark paint was, hadn't quite invented waterproof glow-in-the-dark paint at this point. And so Douglas MacArthur, of all people, you know, the top general in the Pacific, was like, sure, this might work, but what happens when they get wet?
Yeah.
A little like gremlins, right? You don't want to get them wet. In this case, the foxes would come up on the shore and they wouldn't have glow-in-the-dark paint on anymore.
Yeah.
And that kind of defeated the whole purpose.
We're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back with more with Vince Houghton when we come back in just a moment.
In case you missed it, there's a big presidential election coming up in 2020. The Skim wants you to live smarter, which means staying informed, registering to vote, and then, when the time comes, showing up at the polls. If you're wondering how many Democrats you can fit into one debate, the answer is a lot. The first Dem debate is this week, and The Skim has everything you need to know about who's on stage. Just go to theskim.com/debate. You can skim the candidates' resumes, watch some of their interview pitches for 2020, and know what to expect before they all start talking over each other. You can find everything you need at theskim.com/debate. That's theskim, SKIMM.com/debate. Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. They've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started, using precise geographic detail and clear-cut historical insights. You can even trace your ancestors' journeys over time, following how and why your family moved from place to place. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree so your ancestors become more than just a name. Only Ancestry can tell such a rich story with unique features that give a more complete picture about a person. I just got my own Ancestry DNA results back. I always knew I had a lot of German and English in me, according to Ancestry about 58% German and 31% British. But what I didn't know is that my ethnic background is a lot more diverse than I ever realized. I was totally surprised to find out that I'm 6% Norwegian, 2% Portuguese, 2% European Jewish, and even 1% Russian. They also match my DNA to close and distant relatives who are also on Ancestry. Turns out, I have over 100 different cousins all over the world. Guess I'm going to need a lot more Christmas cards this year. Now Ancestry DNA has set me off on a whole new adventure, and I can't wait to see what else I discover on my own family tree. Go to Ancestry.com/kick today for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com/kick for 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/kick. And now, back to the show.
Going back briefly to bat bombs and Project X-Ray, isn't there a story where they tested it on a military base and they ended up burning down our base?
Yeah, so that they had to put the bats into hibernation because they're going to put them inside a truck to bring them from the cave to the testing site. And they'd built a fake Japanese village, essentially wood and paper, like the Japanese villages were. And the idea was that bats were all essentially – they had incendiary devices, napalm, attached to their legs or their body. And when they were released, they would go to these attics and eaves and nooks and crannies of these Japanese villages and then explode and then burn Japan to the ground. But they miscalculated how long it would take these bats to come out of hibernation. They actually did this twice. An earlier test – they overestimated, and the bats were dropped from an airplane before they had woken up completely. And I don't care if you've got wings and you can fly. If you're unconscious, you're going to hit the ground as hard as the rest of us are. And so they almost – they reverse overcompensated in the other direction. And so they were already awake when they opened up the doors to the truck. And so they flew in every direction known to man. And the good news is about half of them went to that fake Japanese city, the test site, and burned it to the ground. Huh. Mission accomplished. The bad news is the other half of the bats went to the working U.S. Army airfield with its barracks and towers and airfields and burned that to the ground. So it's a win-win really for the testers. They're like, you know, we have to explain the reason that we just burned down a U.S. Army airfield. But this is a proof of concept.
Yeah, I was going to say proof of concept.
Yep.
Now you also get into the plot to overthrow or kill Fidel Castro, including Operation Northwoods. You say you almost didn't include this one in the book. Why?
So Northwoods is it's flypaper for conspiracy theorists. Mm-hmm. And this is conspiracy theorists of all stripes, right? The wackadoodle, like the lizard people are going to suck in our precious bodily fluids to the second shooter on the grassy knoll and everyone in between. But the problem you run into is anytime you hear the word false flag being thrown around, you get a little worried because that's kind of the manna from heaven for the conspiracy theorists. And so this is a true false flag operation. This isn't a fake conspiracy nut one. This is a real one that the U.S. government came up with. And essentially, the idea was that Castro is a lot of things to a lot of different people, or he was a lot of things to a lot of different people. you know, whether he's a revolutionary or a monster, or if he was someone who freed the people of Cuba or subjugated them for decades of horrible leadership. One thing we all agree on is that Castro wasn't stupid. And the U.S. government needed a reason to for the rest of the world to buy into why we would invade and kick out Castro, certainly after Bay of Pigs. And Castro wasn't going to give us one. There's no reason that he thought it made any sense whatsoever to antagonize the United States. He wasn't going to pick a fight with us. So we had to make it look like he was picking a fight with us. What Operation Northwoods called for is this false flag operation where we would dress up Cuban exiles in Cuban army uniforms and have them attack Guantanamo Bay. At the same time, we would blow up an American ship in Havana Harbor, a la Remember the Maine incident from the Spanish-American War. But most problematic for me were two ideas that popped up within the United States. One was to either hijack or bomb a U.S. airliner flying from Miami to Washington, or, and this is really where it hit home for me, to lay out a series of pipe bombs in Miami to blow up near and around the Cuban exile community. And the reason it mattered to me is because both of my parents, who met as undergraduates at the University of Miami in the 1960s, could have been walking down Little Havana Road at that point when that pipe bomb went off. And we know how good the U.S. Army is at limiting collateral damage. And I don't need to have seen Back to the Future as many times as I have to realize that could be really problematic for me.
Wow.
And so I'm in a position where I don't like this personally. And at the same time, it's one of the ones that really is not the finest hour for the U.S. military.
Yeah. So that was a real false flag operation that the conspiracy theorists can now point to and say these aren't crazy speculative things when we say that, you know, maybe we attacked ourselves on 9/11 or something. Huh?
Well, they can and they can't, because what the real message about Operation Northwoods is that it never happened. And it didn't just not happen because some war ended or something. And it didn't happen because the system worked. The system we've designed in this country, where you have civilian control of the military, where you have checks and balances in different branches, where you have the checks, whether it's Congress's check over the money or one branch, you know, fighting against another for appropriations, the system worked. In this case, it got all the way up to the White House, so it got through a lot of the roadblocks that have been set up. But in this case, President Kennedy said, no, we don't do that.
Good for him.
Yeah, and so the whole conspiracy thing is that you have to have everybody in on it. From top to bottom. And this is one where that almost happened. But in this case, Kennedy said no. Yeah. And that's what makes conspiracy so difficult, is that you need all these people to agree to stuff, and that rarely ever happens.
Yeah, yeah. Everything has to go perfectly according to plan, and that almost never happens in government, does it?
Right, exactly.
Now, we've all heard of the CIA plot to take out Castro with an exploding cigar. On the long list of weird ideas we had to kill, capture, or undermine Castro, where does that one rank?
Well, the funny part is that the story that I tell in this chapter, I tell all the different ones, and they're all unique, whether it's a exploding seashell or sending in his ex-girlfriend to go kill him. And then basically Castro is so seductive that she holds out the gun and he says, you can't kill me, I'm Cuba. And then she drops the gun and they fall into bed together and make sweet love instead of her killing him. I actually look at one of the simplest plans to try to kill Castro, and that's take a rifle and get in an overwatch position and then shoot him in the head. And the irony is this was one that never happened and never was even attempted, although the CIA went and attempted 30 other ones that were spectacularly complicated. and they just went off and tried everything from exploding cigars to thallium salts in his shoes, which I thought was one of my favorite ones, the idea. Thallium salts are essentially what you'd find in like a Nair hair care, you know, like a hair removal product.
Okay.
With the idea that he put his shoes out every night to get them shined, and then in the morning he'd wake up, put the shoes on, and it would make his beard fall out. And the CIA thought that the Cubans looked at Castro with this like machismo.
Yeah.
And this Cuban like apparently it worked, right? The woman we sent like fell into bed with him because of this machismo. But that if his beard fell out, they'd stop following him because he wasn't the beard anymore. All of these plans were tried in one way or another. And the simplest of all, a rifle, a bullet, his forehead was never attempted. Although we did, the chapter talked about the fact that we did have a volunteer and they tried to get him into Cuba and it was just unable to do so.
Okay. So it didn't work because we just couldn't get a guy with a rifle into the country, huh?
Well, which is ironic since it's an island. I don't know why it's so difficult to get somebody inside an island. True. It's not like there's only one port of entry. It's everywhere is a port of entry.
Yeah. Some of these ideas, such as weaponizing a tsunami or building an iceberg boat, sound like the kind of diabolical plans hatched from a James Bond villain. And I believe that there's actually one here that is straight out of a Bond movie, the Sun Gun. This is something that was seriously developed, right?
Yeah, and I almost didn't include this one also because it's the Nazis, right? And most right. of the chapters, you have some empathy or at least some sympathy for those scientists and engineers and others who are working on these projects and kind of the red tape they got to deal with. I didn't really want anyone to feel any empathy for the Nazis, so it was a little tricky to include this one. But this was, again, there's a James Bond movie with Icarus, which was a satellite that had right. – that harnessed the power of the sun and blasted the DMZ in this case. It was a dumb plot twist. The idea of you have the power of the sun and the only thing you care about is North Korea invading South Korea. go for it. But whatever, that was a plot. But that was from a true Nazi program where they did some serious research and they expended some serious resources to try to develop a way to harness the power of the sun to essentially vaporize their enemies here on Earth. And one of the men who was responsible for it, the guy who had the plan for it, would actually go on later to work on the American space program as Wernher von Braun's assistant. He was actually Wernher von Braun's teacher at one point. And then von Braun kind of became more prominent and then kind of flipped around the other way. So this is not a wackadoodle. This is not some crazy guy. This is somebody who helped us get to the moon. But his idea at the time was to build this death ray. Well, he wouldn't call it a death ray, actually. He thought the Germans, and this is kind of talk about kind of how naive he was, this would be a wonderful way to make sure that places on Earth would always have sun if they wanted to grow crops, or if there was a flood, you could actually vaporize the water, and so the floodwaters would go down. It's like, this is all peaceful purposes, Mr. Hitler. As long as you do that, we're all good. And of course, the Germans took one look at it and said, uh-huh, peaceful, right? And they started having visions of being able to vaporize people from space.
Wow. So, yeah, the whole concept was basically like burning ants with a magnifying glass, just on this gigantic scale.
Yeah, the idea was that you would have a football field-sized convex mirror up in space that would take the rays from the sun and beam it down to a single point. And then you can melt your enemies like the evil Nazi tote at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Just kind of and that was, of course, you can imagine for the Nazis, that was, you know, about as good as it gets.
Yeah. And you discuss a number of Cold War era programs that either used nukes or were meant to guard against hostile nukes from another country, particularly the Soviet Union. Boy, talk about acting out of desperation. Did the threat of nuclear war take things to a whole new level of insanity?
Well, that's why there's a whole section that focuses on those. And because if there's not a thing throughout our history that made us more, I guess, rightfully desperate. I mean, this is a legit existential threat where it's not just a lot of people dying, it's everybody dying. And it's every human, every plant, every animal, everything on Earth, except maybe the cockroaches. And so there's reason for us to be a little freaked out about it. And then in that case, we came up with some extraordinary ideas to try to mitigate the damage that could be done to the United States, but also to find ways to even use nuclear weapons for quote unquote peaceful purposes, mm-hmm. try to justify their existence beyond just killing everybody on Earth.
Yeah. There were actually attempts to harness nuclear weapons for peaceful purposes, such as excavating, mining, underground engineering, but leave it to your home state of Florida to come up with the idea to nuke a hurricane. That just sounds like something that some guy up in the panhandle with a beer in one hand and a gun in another would try to do, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there's a lot of those. Yeah. So there's a lot of those ideas floating around. Well, this is part of a program called the Plowshare Program, which was an attempt to find, like you said, peaceful uses for nuclear weapons. And in many cases, this is to try to justify nuclear weapons for something other than mass human genocide.
Okay.
Which is great, right? You have to hand it to scientists to try to kind of turn lemons into lemonade in this case, where maybe we can use it to, you know, open up new harbors and passageways through mountains, et cetera. Well, there's a meteorologist named Jack Reed who had other ideas. And this idea was because he had spent a lot of time working for like the atmospheric tests right after World War II, like in the Bikini Islands, and the kind of famous, if you've seen pictures of the nukes going off. You need meteorologists to understand the wind patterns. You didn't want essentially the fallout to blow back onto, you know, all the VIPs watching it or onto inhabited islands. So you had meteorologists out there. And he watched this and said, this is interesting. The power of this weapon could potentially be used to stop as far as a meteorologist is concerned, the world's worst natural disaster, and that's hurricanes. And the concept behind it wasn't terrible. The problem was, scientifically, it didn't make a lot of sense. He wanted to – his plan A was to launch nukes into the middle of a hurricane to try to blow out the eye, essentially to disrupt the eye of a hurricane to prevent the circulation that makes it so powerful.
Okay.
Most likely that wouldn't have worked because each hurricane has the power of like 100 million nuclear weapons inside of it. Plan B, I've actually talked to people who say that Plan B might have had a possibility of working. In this case, it was to explode weapons on the outskirts, on the outside of the hurricane, to try to get it to shift its direction, its trajectory. Hurricanes tend, if you ever watch a map, they go westward, like toward Florida, and then a lot of them will just cut straight north. And that's kind of a natural because of the Florida Straits and because of the way the water and the water patterns and the weather patterns work. Reed was like, what if we can get it to cut north earlier? What if we can get it to never get to land? And it will just kind of go out into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and peter out, and then no people are actually going to be harmed by it. So his idea was to detonate a very large, and we're talking in the megaton range, nuclear weapon either on one side of a hurricane or on both sides to try to get it to turn faster. The problem was the only way to test his theory was actually do his theory. And then most people were a little hesitant about the potential of this not working, yeah. Which meant that maybe okay. Miami gets hit by a Category 4 hurricane that's not just wind blowing and rain, but it's radioactive wind and rain blowing yeah. at 200 miles an hour. So people were a little hesitant to do this. But the fun part about this, again, talking about my home state, is there's NOAA, the organization that does weather and atmospherics for the U.S. government, has a frequently asked questions page on their website. And a lot of them are about like things like lightning strikes and about, you know, tornadoes. Well, there's a frequently asked question on there right now where someone says, can we use nuclear weapons to blow up hurricanes? In 2019. Now, what's wonderful about FAQs is that first word is frequently, which means it's not just one guy who sent in this. Yeah. It's a lot of people yeah. who send in this message. So Jack Reed was on to something, at least the cultural zeitgeist yeah. of people thinking this was a good idea.
Well, I have to ask about the project that gave you the title of the book, Project A119, the plan to nuke the moon. First off, why would anyone ever want to nuke the moon? What's the point of that?
Well, the project came up right after Sputnik. Mm-hmm. So 1957, the Soviets launched the first man-made anything into space. And it was just a beach ball-sized sphere of metal that made a beep-beep noise. But it was enough to scare the living hell out of everybody in the West, mainly because, A, it went up there on the top of an ICBM. So if you can launch Sputnik into space, you could put a nuke on the top of this missile and have it come down on us. But in a bigger picture, kind of diplomatic sense, it scared us because it sent a message to the rest of the world. The message was the Soviets had not only caught up with or potentially overtaken the United States in science and technology. And we had always enjoyed the lead. We had enjoyed the lead since the beginning of the 20th century when the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. We had built the atomic bomb during World War II. We had built the incandescent light bulb. We were chocolate chip cookies, microwave popcorn, the Etch-a-Sketch. Like we were the scientific and technological wonders of the world. Yep. Now, why did that matter during the Cold War? Well, it mattered because the developing world, Latin America, Africa, East Asia, the Middle East, were looking toward either the U.S. or the Soviets as who are we going to follow? Who do we actually want to side up with? And that was the real battle of the Cold War. It's recruiting the developing world. And the Soviets had just gone way ahead of us with the launch of Sputnik. And they would a couple of years later, actually, in 1961, when Yuri Gagarin became the first man to go into space. So we had to try to figure out something very quickly to try to show the world who's boss, to try to demonstrate to the world that we had not been passed in science and technology. And what better way to do that than to detonate a thermal nuclear weapon on the moon?
Well, I mean, that's one way to prevent the Russians from being the first ones on the moon, I guess.
Right. Yeah. If you completely contaminate the entire surface of the moon, no one will ever get there.
You know, many of these operations were classified at the time and were only declassified years later. The question that comes to my mind is, how do we know that the CIA and the military might not be cooking up something equally idiotic right now?
We don't. That's the great part about that. It's going to keep me writing books like this until I'm 90 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when the sequel comes out, it's just the next group of things coming forward. I mean, I think that one thing that I'm hoping slows us down is the fact mm-hmm. that we're not as desperate as we were. Yeah. You know, these are all programs that came out during a time at which we were just terrified of what the world could bring. You saw that a little bit after 9/11, where even though we didn't have an existential threat, we just kind of overreacted in many respects to things that perhaps weren't as dire. I'm not trying to minimize what happened on 9/11, but there were some overstepping that happened after 9/11 and that you might not have seen otherwise. But right now, we're not in a position where I think that we would agree to do a lot of these programs because we just are not as desperate as they were during that time. What I'm afraid of is that some true existential threat does pop up, or one that we start realizing is existential, and then we react in such a way that we kind of not only are thinking about programs like this, but actually go through and do programs like this.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Vince. Do you think that it's fair for us to be laughing about some of these schemes? I mean, the military and sometimes intelligence agencies are always criticized for being a little too set in their ways and not fostering outside-of-the-box thinking. Yes, some of these ideas didn't pan out, but great failures sometimes lead to great successes. Don't we want to encourage this willingness to test things out?
Yeah, and I want to emphasize that none of these programs actually failed. None of these programs, they weren't given a chance to fail. I mean, so maybe they would have, but they never even got to that point. And I think that one of the things that I want to emphasize here is that it's very unfair for us to apply our 2019 hindsight to these programs. I say that right in the beginning of the introduction. The knee-jerk reaction to all these stories is to think about these people and go, what were they thinking? I want you to ask that same question, but not that way. I want you to ask it without that kind of snarkiness to it. I want you to go, what were they thinking? What were the mindset of the people who were working on these programs at the time? What were they afraid of? What were they worried about? What problems were they trying to solve? Because that's the only way we can actually learn from history. Historians all the time look at what we call outcome history, where it's like, let's figure out whether or not it was good or bad by what happens, the outcome. I think that's a complete waste of time. I think that we're doing a disservice to ourselves. We're doing a disservice to those historical actors by only looking at outcome. I argue the opposite. I argue it's about intent, what we tried to do. Sometimes outcome is not up to us. Sometimes outcome is up to something else. It's up to the gods. It's up to weather. It's up to what the other guy does. So it doesn't really matter whether or not it worked or not. It matters what we intended to do. And in this case, this is a book full of those things.
Yeah, it's a very entertaining read and completely fascinating. Before we go, what would you want today's leaders in Washington to take away from this book?
I didn't write this necessarily for that in mind. I'm a historian, and they really kind of give us the side eye when we try to insert ourselves into contemporary politics. But in many cases, I think that there are times when we need to kind of take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. And that's really what this book says to do is we're desperate. We try to do things. We try to do things quickly. We try to do things with expediency. And there are times when probably it would have worked out better if we had just taken a deep breath and thought about things before we jumped in and acted. We don't do that very often today. Everything is immediate. And if you try to ponder something, people say, why haven't you made a decision yet? And you get pressure. And the 24-hour news cycle and et cetera, everything else doesn't help this. But it used to be where when we made foreign policy decisions, we thought about them. We pondered them. We brought in experts and had conversations. We weren't doing it through Twitter. And the current president is a great example of this, but I can't imagine he's going to be the last president to govern through Twitter. So it sounds like it's a pot shot at him, but it's not. He's just the first to do this. And we don't do it in 240 character bytes, right? This should be thoughtful. And these programs were thoughtful to a degree, but I think when people started really thinking about them is when they said, oh, no, we probably should think about things in a different way.
Well, once more, the book is called Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. Vince Houghton, thanks so much for talking with me.
Happy to be here.
Thanks again to Vince Houghton for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Subscribe to his podcast, Spycast, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to get podcasts, and follow him on Twitter at @IntelHistorian. Also, next time you're in Washington, be sure to visit the International Spy Museum. Whatever struggles you're facing, from depression and anxiety to trauma and grief, BetterHelp can connect you with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment.
It's so convenient, you can schedule secure video or phone sessions, as well as chat and text with your therapist. And anything you share is completely confidential. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. KickAss News listeners even get 10% off your first month with the discount code KICK. So why not get started? Simply go to betterhelp.com/kick and fill out a questionnaire to get matched with a counselor you'll love today. Again, that's betterhelp.com/kick. Be sure to subscribe to KickAss News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickAssNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to KickAss News.